Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Bob McDonald. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks. On this week's show, one species' feces is another one's treasure. But this treasure might be poisoned.
We saw many instances of chimps coming, black and white colobus monkeys, and red duiker. They were all coming to feast on this bat poop.
And 5 million years ago, a gigantic salmon with tusks swam the seas of the Pacific.
They actually look more like a warthog. Some people have described them almost looking like a mustache. Looks like they could have been spikes and used for tools.
Plus, desperate measures might be working for woodland caribou, the Gulf oil spill and the fish we don't see, and why tiny black holes might be spinning through our solar system. All this today on Quirks and Quarks. A few years ago, researchers working in the lush tropical Budongo rainforest in Uganda saw something peculiar. A group of chimps were huddled together at the base of a big hollow tree. They were reaching in and retrieving something that they were then eating. And upon closer inspection, what they were eating was kind of nasty. It was bat poop. Apart from the obvious ick factor, it made the researchers wonder, why were they eating it? And what were they being exposed to? Bats are known to be carriers of several nasty pathogens that can spread to other wildlife and to humans. So they recruited some epidemiologists and began to investigate. And what they found could have an impact on our understanding of how diseases escape wildlife into the wider world. Dr. Tony Goldberg is a professor of epidemiology in the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was part of the team. Dr. Goldberg, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you for having me.
Now tell me about these chimps eating bat poop or bat guano. Is this a new behavior for them?
This is a new behavior, and you're right. Ick. When we first saw this a few years ago, we had never seen it before. So that's despite the fact that these chimps have been the subjects of research for decades. So if they had been doing it, we would have noticed.
So what did you do to try to understand this behavior better?
We thought about it, and we realized that chimpanzees have a problem that they have to solve on a daily basis. Where do you get your minerals? And in forests like Budongo in Uganda, natural sources that are rich in minerals are rare. So we thought, aha, maybe they're doing this because they're in search of minerals in their diet.
Now, were the chimps the only animals doing this, or were other animals also attracted to the bat poop?
Over several months, we saw many instances of chimps coming, black and white colobus monkeys, and red duiker, a kind of small, cute forest antelope. And they were all coming to feast on this bat poop.
So why would these animals decide to eat bat poop?
So we knew from decades of research at this site that animals eat weird things in their pursuit of minerals. The question that really got us interested, though, is why did they just start doing this now? Chimpanzees and other animals have their preferred sources of natural dietary minerals. One of those sources, its scientific name is Raphia farinifera, and it used to be very abundant in this environment. And when that tree died, the rotting inner pith of the tree was very rich in sodium and other minerals, and chimpanzees loved it. About 20 years ago, that tree all but disappeared in Budongo. There was a demand in the area for the leaves of that tree to make strings for drying tobacco leaves that were produced during tobacco farming. And these animals lost dietary minerals, so they had to find something else. And that's when we started to see them eating guano, which is rich in the minerals that they used to get from this tree.
Well, how are they able to eat the bat feces and not get horrendously sick to the stomach?
We have all wondered that. I get horrendously sick to the stomach just watching them eat the bat guano. All I can say is that these animals naturally eat soil. It's a behavior that we call geophagy. And it's not too much of a stretch to go from eating soil to eating a pile of something that looks like soil.
Well, what minerals are the chimps getting from the bat poop?
They are getting a lot of phosphorus, also calcium and magnesium. They're getting sodium, not as much as we thought, but phosphorus, magnesium, calcium, and sodium are pretty essential elements for a diet.
Okay, so if it's so nutritious, why is it concerning that the animals are eating these feces?
It's concerning because we know something else about bats. We also know that bats carry interesting and sometimes dangerous pathogens. We think that bats are the source of coronaviruses, many coronaviruses that have caused outbreaks in humans, like the SARS coronaviruses.
So did you find any of those pathogens in the bat guano?
We sure did. We found 27 viruses in this bat guano. Two-thirds of them are things you'd expect to find in insects, because these bats are eating insects, so that wasn't surprising. We found some fairly obscure viruses of mammals, but we also found something surprising, a first cousin relative to SARS coronavirus 2.
Wow. Now, are the chimps showing any signs that they're getting the coronavirus?
They are not. So we have not seen chimps eating this guano and then getting something that looks like a coronavirus disease. That being said, chimps in the wild do get sick and they do get respiratory infections, but they're rarely diagnosed. So we rarely have the opportunity to know what they're infected with, but it's plausible.
So why might this be a problem for human health?
We think that a lot of human epidemics and maybe even pandemics begin in wildlife. This is not a new idea. We've seen this with Ebola, for example. There's decent evidence that some human Ebola virus outbreaks begin when animals in the forest get Ebola, die, and then humans touch the carcasses. And another thing that we realized when we first saw this behavior is that three of the animals that have been implicated as hosts in Ebola outbreaks are chimpanzees, black and white colobus, and duiker, which are the same three animals we saw eating the bat poop.
Well, what does this mean for our understanding of how viruses can spread from bats to other animals and then eventually to us?
It's sort of a missing link because it was never clear how these sorts of chains of events happen in nature.
Well, how could knowing about this missing link help us prevent future disease outbreaks?
I can't help but think, what if the solution to the potential problem of these animals being exposed to bat viruses was as simple as giving farmers a ball of twine so they didn't have to cut down this tree and dry their tobacco leaves? What an incredibly inexpensive and simple solution to this problem.
It's just another amazing example of the unintended consequences of human activity.
Exactly.
Dr. Goldberg, thank you so much for your time.
You are very welcome.
Dr. Tony Goldberg is a professor of epidemiology at the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Caribou are an iconic Canadian animal with a long history in our landscape, but they also have a long history of struggling when humans encroach on their habitat. The southern mountain caribou of British Columbia and Alberta are particularly vulnerable. They live in small groups and need large, undisturbed swaths of old-growth forest in order to survive. Conservation groups started rallying to protect these caribou back in the 1950s, but decades of half measures did nothing, and populations still continued to decline. So, in recent years, scientists have been trying anything and everything to save these animals, from long-term programs like habitat restoration to short-term strategies that can seem extreme, like captive breeding programs, penning mothers and offspring to keep them safe, and even killing predatory wolves. And in a new study, they've looked at which, if any of these measures is working, and whether caribou were really better or worse off as a result. Dr. Clayton Lamb is a wildlife scientist at Biodiversity Pathways and the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. He led the study. Dr. Lamb, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me today.
First of all, tell me about these caribou. I mean, most of us are familiar with the caribou in the high Arctic. What are these mountain caribou like?
So in British Columbia and Alberta, especially in the southern half of the provinces, there's a special type of caribou called a mountain caribou. And these are caribou that basically live up in the mountains of the Rockies and the Purcells and the Selkirks. And they eat arboreal lichen, so the lichen in trees, and also the lichen found along the ground. And, you know, these are animals that migrate sort of up and down the slopes as opposed to these far distances like we see in the Arctic.
Oh, so they stay within the Rockies.
Yeah, exactly. They actually typically stay in fairly small areas, sort of distinct herds right now, partly due to how few there are left, but they don't move nearly as far as the high Arctic animals.
Now, why is it so challenging to keep their populations healthy?
Yeah, so southern mountain caribou are one of the most challenging conservation issues that Canada has right now. So their populations have declined dramatically over the last 50 years or so. And it really comes down to a landscape that's just not working for these caribou. The landscape has been transformed from industrialized resource extraction, so logging, which has basically produced a landscape that is more attractive for deer and moose. And that's not necessarily a bad thing in that that can be good for hunters, and it is good for deer and moose, but it brings in wolves. And caribou basically struggle to coexist with high predator densities. And those wolves prey on caribou at unsustainable rates and have precipitated very dramatic declines of caribou populations across southern Canada.
Well, when you say dramatic decline, how much have their populations gone down?
By over 50% in the last 30 years. And a number of those distinct herds have actually been completely lost. So they've gone to zero, and the actual distribution of caribou is shrinking quite dramatically.
Wow. Take me through some of the interventions that are being used to help save the caribou.
Yeah, so there's a number of interventions that are being used to keep caribou on the landscape while habitat restoration and protection is underway. And the important thing there is to sort of create a landscape that works for caribou could take decades. And so in that interim period, we need to keep caribou around. And those interventions are largely focused on reducing this unsustainable predation on caribou. And so they range from maternal pens, which is bringing caribou into sort of a high elevation enclosure where they would sort of naturally be at that time of year to have their calves in safety. Some of the other actions are reducing the density of wolves. So, you know, because this landscape has been so dramatically transformed, the density of wolves is much, much higher than caribou historically coexisted with. So there is the direct removal of wolves, and then also other ways to reduce wolves through reducing the number of moose, which eventually should reduce the density of wolves. So, you know, people are trying all sorts of different things, including also feeding caribou and just trying to keep these caribou around as best as they can using the tools that we have in hand.
And what did you find?
What we found was that since 1990s, the population of southern mountain caribou has declined quite dramatically by over 50%. So in the 1990s, there was around 10,000 caribou, and today there's just shy of 5,000. But we did find that those recovery measures that were applied have increased the population by quite a bit, by over 1,500 animals compared to what would have been here otherwise. And what is really working for caribou is the reduction of predators, so the reduction of wolves and additional recovery interventions that are supporting the recovery of caribou on top of the wolf reductions are maternal penning, so to keep those calves safe, and feeding caribou.
So would you consider the programs a success then?
I mean, from a caribou perspective and from the perspective of trying to keep caribou around and averting the loss of those herds, yes, the wolf reductions and the remainder of the restoration or recovery actions that were applied have avoided the extirpation of a number of those herds.
Mm-hmm. Now, we've talked on this program a lot about the importance of predators in an ecosystem. Are you concerned that these interventions of reducing the number of predators could have other problems in the ecosystems?
Yeah, I think we have to consider that. I mean, we don't want to sort of trade one problem for another. You know, I think we are seeing some shifts in the landscape and the composition of species on it. And I think we have to keep our mind to what the additional ecological consequences could be. From the wolf perspective, generally, the wolf density is brought quite low, like the target is less than 3 wolves per 1,000 square kilometers. And it generally quickly rebounds after they're reduced due to dispersal from outside the area. So there usually remain some wolves in these areas, but not as many as there were previously.
Why is it important to protect the caribou to this extent?
Well, in this case, it's sort of this binary option of if we don't protect them, they will be lost. There are a number of these herds that have already been completely lost before these interventions took place. And if the interventions that did take place weren't done, a number of the other herds would have been lost. And so we're essentially in the situation where we either act to keep caribou on the landscape or they will rapidly not be in British Columbia and Alberta. It does speak to the larger vision here, though, that this is an interim action, and we don't necessarily want to be solely sustaining a caribou population off these interim actions. They are expensive. They have ecosystem and ethical concerns, especially on the wolf call side. And this is an intervention to stave off extirpation. But we need to be thinking forward to restoration, of course. So how do we make a landscape that will work for these caribou so that these are truly interim actions and not doesn't form the backbone of what keeps caribou around forever?
So what's the next step for you now that you have this information?
I mean, I think that the work here can inform, you know, what are the effective strategies to keep caribou around in the interim? Like, if folks are going to be applying these interventions, then we should use the ones that are working. And for our research program is certainly shifting rapidly towards this restoration focus. So trying to think about what does a landscape that works for caribou look like? And how do we create it as fast as possible, as efficiently as possible? And what are the strategies that we haven't thought of that can help us do that?
Dr. Lamb, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Clayton Lamb is a wildlife scientist with Biodiversity Pathways and the University of British Columbia, Okanagan. The Chinook salmon is the biggest salmon living in the Pacific Northwest today. It can grow up to be a meter and a half long and weigh over 100 pounds. But once it had a relative that dwarfed it. The now extinct Oncorhynchus restrosus was the largest salmon known to science. It was almost twice the length of the Pacific salmon alive today, a full 3 meters. And if that wasn't impressive enough, it also sported 2 oversized front teeth that originally earned it the nickname of the saber-toothed salmon. But a new study by paleontologist Karen Clayson suggests that this name needs a rethink, because those teeth weren't fangs at all. Instead, they stuck out of the side of the salmon's head like tusks. Dr. Clayson is a paleoichthyologist and professor of anatomy at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. Dr. Clayson, welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really glad to talk about this.
When did we first learn about these giant salmon?
The first giant salmons were found probably in the 1960s, and then they were ultimately published in the early 1970s.
What did they look like?
So what we can tell from most of their bones is that they look like really enormous versions of the salmon that we're aware of now. And they had this very unique bone at the front of their mouths that would have had this very large bulbous shape to them and these enormous teeth on them. And based on what we think that most of the animals would have been related to, we assumed that they faced down like sabers. So that was the original construction, to have this very large head with big fangs that faced into the mouth.
When did these salmon live?
So we have evidence that they would have been around about 5 million years ago at this point in time, probably transitioning between the Miocene and the Pliocene.
And where were the fossils found?
So the fossils that we found in around the time of like 2011 till 2014, those were found in the same locality. It's known as the Gateway locality in Oregon.
Oh, so they were Pacific salmon then?
Yes, definitely. They are absolutely part of this entire group known as the Pacific salmon. And you gave the full scientific name earlier, which is Oncorhynchus rostrosus. And Oncorhynchus is the genus name for all of the living and modern Pacific salmon as well.
Well, what made you reconsider these teeth that were originally thought to look like fangs?
Well, the fact was that they found remarkable specimens that had all of these bones in place. So everything was in situ. Everything was preserved in three dimension. We had two fish very closely situated together as if they were in a breeding situation. And they both had these enormous bones plus their tusks. And they were all facing outwards.
What do you mean facing outwards? Tell me about that.
So as we thought with the saber-tooth salmon configuration, they would have faced down like we have with all of the modern salmon today. Like they would have been able to grab at their food and sliced it or grabbed and held on really tight. Turns out that these are filter feeding salmon. And so they wouldn't have used their teeth for that anyways. And so now these teeth that are facing outwards, they actually look more like a warthog. Some people describe them almost looking like a mustache. They have this completely unique configuration that looks like they could have been spikes and used for tools that if they slashed their head from side to side, they would have created a very, very unique aspect to these fish.
So what part of their face did they stick out of?
So right at the tip of their rostrum, it's called. So right at the front where we would expect the in modern salmon to have this major change happen during metamorphosis. So if you've ever taken a look at pictures of when they're breeding, they're this bright red color and they have this kind of greenish head. And all of the males have a very, very long rostrum. Their nose almost looks like Gonzo from the Muppets. This is the same bone that is changing in the fish that we're describing. And what's also interesting is though that males and females are doing it in these fossils, which is unlike what the modern do now.
Boy. And were they curved? Did they curve back or curve forward or stick straight out?
They kind of blew up like balloons right at the front, and then they just stuck straight out towards the side. So instead of creating this long hook in the front, they actually more a tiny little hammerhead almost, if you will.
Wow. And you say both the males and the females had this.
They did. They did. So unlike all of the salmon that are around today, we only see the changes occurring in a few of the bones. And so we still see the changes that are occurring due to metamorphosis in the males, but not on this particular bone, not this premaxilla with these teeth. So this is occurring in both the male and the female on this particular fossil, which is definitely unique.
Well, you said that these salmon were filter feeders, sort of like baleen whales. So they ate plankton and stuff like that. They didn't eat other fish. Mm-hmm. So why would they need these large teeth sticking out the side of their head?
That's a great question. So the ideas that we've been coming up with have a lot to do with strategy for probably defense, maybe a little bit of offense. And you know, these were really large. Perhaps they could have been a very tasty meal for some type of predator. And the fact that they were so large, they had these very strong muscles that would have helped to move their entire body while swimming. These would also be able to move their head. And so they could create a lot of force to ward off some type of predator. They could have created a lot of force to keep other competition out of the way. It makes me think a little bit of like when you think of the street races in the movie Grease and there's spikes coming out of their tires or something to just keep them away from you. Perhaps by the time that they got up to the area where they were ready to breed, they would have used them for tools to actually build the nests where the eggs and the sperm would have been deposited. And once those nests are in place and the fry exists, they could have potentially protected that nest from other sorts of predators as well.
Now, how can you tell that this wasn't a one-off, that not all of these giant salmon had these spiked teeth?
Well, the fact that we didn't have only one specimen with this configuration was a good tip off. And then we were actually using medical imaging. We used CT scanning at an industrial strength to look inside the rock and start to remove the sediment and the matrix that was surrounding and protecting the really delicate parts of the bones that we don't tend to get to see otherwise when the fossils are preserved. So by using this technology to peer inside the entire skull, we were able to find the small processes that fit together like puzzle pieces that said that this is the actual configuration that it should have been.
What went through your mind when you realized that these salmon had this strange formation sticking out the side of their head?
I just thought it was really fascinating and thought to myself, again, why would you be doing this? And why don't we see it in a lot of other animals now? It's not a strategy that a lot of animals are using at all. And so it was pretty unique.
Well, why do you think modern day salmon don't have these teeth?
So if we think about it from an evolutionary perspective, these are not the ancestors to the modern salmon. They're probably more derived or as derived as some of the ones that are around now. So it wouldn't have been something that came first and then left the modern ones around. These actually existed and coexisted at the same time as some of the species that are around today, like the sockeye. And I think it was a very interesting experiment. And so not a lot of the other ones, though, would have tried it, it seems, at least based on what we can see in the fossil record.
So for any time travelers out there, if you go back a million years or so, don't go swimming in the ocean.
Yeah, I know. There are some pretty large animals that are in the ocean nowadays, but they don't school quite as much as what we would think about for those salmon as well. So could you imagine seeing so many of them all together at once coming and charging at you? I don't know. That would have been pretty crazy.
Dr. Clayson, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Karen Clayson is a paleoichthyologist and an anatomist at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine.
I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, host of The Big Story. For 6 years now, we've been telling one story a day, every one of them about something that matters to Canadians. This spring, though, we're going deeper. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt, the inside story of Ontario's Greenbelt scandal. From political games to stag and doe parties, endangered species, RCMP investigations, and Las Vegas massages, you will hear the full story. The Big Story presents Pay Dirt. New episodes every Monday, and you can get them all by following The Big Story wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bob McDonald, and you're listening to Quirks and Quarks on CBC Radio 1. Coming up later in the program, could the universe be full of tiny black holes that occasionally blast through our planet?
So it's like a bullet through cotton candy. These things enter one side of the planet, they're out the other, and then they're off into space, never to come back again.
14 years ago this month, the Deepwater Horizon oil well disaster began, ultimately releasing an estimated 800 million liters of oil and gas into the Gulf of Mexico. It was the largest accidental marine oil spill in history. At the time, scientists flocked to the scene to understand how this unprecedented pollution, not just the oil, but the chemical dispersants released to break up the spill, would affect the rich ecosystem in those waters. Much of the early research focus was on the economically important species in the area, like tuna, swordfish, shrimp, and oysters, and these species fortunately recovered quickly. That seemed like good news. Well, Canadian biologist Prosanta Chakrabarty was also on the scene at the time, but he was focused on the rarer creatures that live only in the deepest parts of the Gulf, closest to where the chaos was happening. And for these animals, the picture is less rosy. In his latest study, Dr. Chakrabarty and his colleagues report that out of the 78 endemic species, 29 of them haven't been spotted in the years since the spill. Dr. Chakrabarty is a professor and curator of fishes at Louisiana State University's Museum of Natural Science. Hello and welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we've heard for a while how the fish populations in the Gulf seem to be holding steady after the spill, but now you're saying that's not the whole story?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not. You know, we typically focus on the food fish that we eat, right? The fish that are commercially important. But those are only a handful of species, while there's actually 1,500 or more species in the Gulf of Mexico of fishes. And those are the ones I'm also interested in that are often overlooked. And that's the focus of these papers.
Well, why did you want to focus on the animals in the deep ocean?
Well, the oil spill happened in the deep sea. That's the part of the world, not just the Gulf of Mexico, but of the world that we know the least about, this deep sea, cold, perpetually dark ecosystem that houses some amazing species that are bioluminescent, that are doing all kinds of things that we know very little about. And, you know, if they're endangered, then somebody has to speak for them. And that's our role as scientists.
Well, now 14 years after the disaster, what do we know about the long-term effects of the oil spill?
Not as much as we would suspect that we would know by now. Still, 14 years later, you know, if another spill were to happen tomorrow, I'm afraid that we just don't know the impacts of how a deep sea environment would be impacted and affected, you know, any better than we were 14 years ago. And that's problematic, and it's in part due to the difficulty in studying the deep sea. There have been efforts to make new collections, to make new environmental impact assessments, but it's still a drop in the bucket compared to how much we could know.
Wow. You mean nobody's been down to actually look at what's going on down there?
Not in a way that people would expect. So it's not like we can easily get to 1,000 meters. Very few submersibles exist that can get to the bottom of the ocean still. And long-term studies are just difficult to do in these perpetually dark environments. And so, you know, figuring out populations of deep sea fishes is almost impossible.
Well, tell me about how you've been looking at the species that seem to be disappearing.
Yeah, for me, as a museum curator, our collections are this library of the Earth's biodiversity. And these collections have specimens or vouchers, as we call them, of creatures from around the world. And so I thought it'd be useful to use this library, and we all share our data, so we can look online and see where specimens from around where the spill happened, where were they collected, when were they collected, and can we make a sort of guesstimate or estimates of how these populations are doing. So I want to know what species have we not seen since the time of the spill or from before the spill that we should know more about. And those are the 29 species that you mentioned that are still, quote, missing. Things that we haven't seen from the time of the spill or before.
So how many animals usually get added to a museum collection?
That's an interesting point. And so it sort of depends if there's survey work being done. So in my own collections here, you know, we have about 300,000 fish from 60 or so different countries. And 300,000 wow. fish sounds like a lot, but 5 million fish are caught every minute by the fishing industry. So often what's being caught in the Gulf and other parts of North America, what's not the target fish, so if they're targeting menhaden, all that other fish gets thrown overboard, the bycatch. And so that's a larger portion of some of the species that might be so-called missing that we might not have data for. And so they only become data when they're in a museum collection, and that's what we're here for.
Are there any species that only exist in the Gulf of Mexico?
Yeah, in fact, those are the species that we were targeting. So there's 1,500 or so species in the Gulf of Mexico, but many of them are found in this very wide range. I was interested in those that are only found in the Gulf of Mexico, so not even in the Caribbean or on the eastern coast of the U.S. So those species, there's only 78 of those species. And so those are the ones that we focused on as sort of a proxy for what's going on in the entirety of the Gulf.
Well, tell me about some of these animals. What are they like?
Yeah, perhaps the most well-known of these will be the pocket shark. So that species was actually described around the time of the oil spill. And it's a shark that's not even a foot long, and it's got a big old head. It's actually very cute as far as sharks go. It's got dark skin. It's bioluminescent. And so it produces light. And there's only been one specimen ever found, ever. There's a fringe lantern shark, which was only seen right before the spill in 2009. There's an eel pout and other sharks and rays and hagfish, things that people don't eat and most people don't think about, but I do and other scientists do. And some of those that I mentioned haven't been seen since the 60s, from well before the spill. But even with targeted efforts, we would expect, you know, to see one or two more specimens. But they are only known from the Gulf, and we haven't seen them since.
Now, is it possible that the reason these species haven't been seen is that, well, they've just evaded capture all these years?
Oh, certainly, yeah. So some of these species have, again, you know, haven't been seen since the 60s. And they're deep sea animals that are very hard to get. The Gulf's a very big place. And so you just have to get lucky sometimes. But with more effort, and especially around the region of the spill, I think we can learn more. And we should learn more about what exists.
Now, you were on site at the oil spill 14 years ago. Did you think you'd still be calling attention to the deep sea animals all these years later?
When I came to Louisiana, and I'm a Canadian who lived in New York for a long time before I moved here in 2008, I didn't really feel like a Louisianan until the oil spill happened. It made me really feel a connection to this place. And all of a sudden, I just fell in love with the Gulf, especially when it was endangered. This 12 weeks of the spill made me really feel like Louisiana was home. And, you know, it's still very much home 15 years later since I've been here. And I couldn't imagine then how little we still know. You know, once the remnants of the oil at the surface was gone, it was out of sight and out of mind. And even though there may be smaller spills, the impact of that spill, I wish we knew more. And I'm surprised we still know so little 15 years later. So the Gulf's this wonderful place shared with several countries that I think deserves more attention.
Dr. Chakrabarty, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me, and thanks for calling attention to the spill.
Dr. Prasanta Chakrabarty is a curator of fishes at Louisiana State University's Museum of Natural Science. Let me take you back to the Big Bang. The universe explodes into existence as an infinitely dense, infinitely hot point, and immediately starts to expand at a tremendous rate. Almost instantaneously, matter evolves out of pure energy, and the tiny proto-universe is filled with super hot stuff. Then, perhaps, something very strange happens.
So it's possible that just white noise, little fluctuations in the density of this huge bath of matter in the early universe, could have produced huge numbers of black holes that could have had really any range of masses.
That's physicist Matt Kaplan. And what he's talking about is the theory of primordial black holes. These are black holes that have been around for 13.7 billion years, since the birth of our universe. And if researchers' suspicions are correct, they could come in a range of sizes, from the unimaginably tiny to the supermassive. And the universe might be full of them, invisible, largely undetectable. Some of the smallest of these primordial black holes might also be a promising candidate to explain another mystery, the coincidentally invisible and so far undetectable dark matter that astronomers say makes up more than 4/5 of the mass of the universe. Dr. Kaplan.
It's just a fact that most of the matter in the universe doesn't light up, it doesn't seem to interact with light, and it doesn't seem to have electric charge. So this puts real restrictions on what it could be. It might be some new undiscovered particle. But when I think of matter that doesn't light up, black holes really fit the bill perfectly, right? I mean, I'm not crazy for thinking that.
Well, history will be the judge. But if he's right that these primordial black holes formed shortly after the Big Bang, the next natural question is, can we find the ones that could be the solution to the dark matter mystery? Well, maybe. And maybe right in our stellar neighborhood. Dr. Kaplan is a professor of physics at Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. Hello, and welcome back to Quirks and Quarks.
Hey, Bob. Good to be back.
First of all, tell me what a primordial black hole is.
So a primordial black hole is a black hole? Let's start with that. A black hole is just this overdense region of space-time that's collapsed on itself to produce a singularity. The question then is, what makes a black hole primordial? And that's when it formed. It takes very dense matter to make black holes. So the most obvious way to do this is in a supernova, and that makes these order solar mass black holes. But the early universe was incredibly dense. So it's possible that just white noise, little fluctuations in the density of this huge bath of matter in the early universe, could have produced huge numbers of black holes that could have had really any range of masses.
Why do you think primordial black holes may be the answer to the dark matter problem?
I like primordial black holes as a dark matter solution because it doesn't require new physics beyond what we already know. If dark matter is a new undiscovered particle, that would be really cool. That would be really exciting. But that's also this massive theoretical garden of how many millions of different possible particles that we could sort of theoretically think up. And that's, you know, a step away from known physics. Black holes are not unknown physics. They are very well known. We've seen plenty of them. We've seen the merging LIGO black holes. So I don't think it would be too much of a stretch to think that some large number could have been produced in the early universe. It seems like it has the fewest assumptions of any dark matter explanation I've ever seen.
Okay, so if primordial black holes are the answer to dark matter, there's a lot of dark matter out there. So what does that mean for how common these little black holes would be?
It depends on their exact mass, right? So the less massive these black holes would be, the more abundant they would be by number. And so they could be whizzing through the solar system even if they're low enough mass.
But if dark matter is made of black holes and they're passing through our solar system, wouldn't we notice that? Because black holes do have a tendency, as you say, to eat things, and stuff
yes.
that falls into them lights up and all that. I mean, wouldn't we see
yes.
that?
They would be very easy to miss. The amount of dark matter in the solar system is comparable to a mountain. So if we said, well, what if that was all a black hole? So what if there was roughly one black hole, the mass of a mountain, passing through the solar system at any given time? That black hole would also be about the size of an atom. So it would be very easy to miss. You're probably not going to find it with a telescope. But you're onto it, which is that occasionally things will hit planets, stars, moons. And when that happens, then something exciting and observable could happen.
Wait a minute. A black hole the size of an atom?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Straightforward homework problem.
Okay.
So it's these sort of asteroid mass black holes that could potentially explain the dark matter.
So what then would happen if one of these atom-sized black holes was to hit the Earth?
So people have thought about this. There are actual, real, peer-reviewed publications about what would happen if one of these itty-bitty, teeny-tiny black holes hit the Earth, if you can believe it or not. So a black hole of that mass would be falling in at a very high speed. It's coming from the galaxy, so it's going fast. It's falling towards the Earth and accelerated by Earth's gravity, so it's going to be fast. So it's going significantly faster than escape velocity when it enters the atmosphere. And it's so small, it can barely eat any mass while it's passing through the planet. So it's like a bullet through cotton candy. These things enter one side of the planet, they're out the other, and then they're off into space, never to come back again. And it all happens in a few seconds.
Wow.
So they're above the atmosphere and they're invisible. And then as soon as you put matter around them that they can start to pull in, they're going to start to get very hot and bright because matter falling into a black hole is going very fast. It gets heated by friction, colliding with other matter that's falling in. And what you get are these really bright accretion disks. These are the pictures that you usually see, those orange bands around black holes.
Mm-hmm.
Those are these accretion disks. So you have a black hole that's now entering the atmosphere, and it is lighting up like a fire as it streaks through the sky, punches through the planet, punches all the way through to the other side, and leaves like a shooting star coming up from the ground.
Okay. So if one passed through my house, would I notice?
Yeah, your house would probably be on fire and... it depends on the mass of the black hole. Because the masses have this huge range of masses, the smallest ones could potentially leave your house intact, and the biggest ones would probably destroy your house and the neighbors.
Now, do we have any evidence that little black holes have gone through the Earth? Any scars? Any holes through the planet?
So, to the best of our knowledge, we haven't found any of these, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. And that's because the Earth has surface processes. It has rain, it has wind, it has erosion, it has seasons. All of these things tend to erase surface impacts and craters. Only the largest, biggest, beefiest craters in deserts stick around for a really long time. So if you did want to look for evidence of primordial black holes hitting the Earth, you should probably start with the moon, because the moon doesn't have those things that would erase the evidence of those impacts.
Okay, so do we have any evidence on the moon? I know it's covered in a lot of craters. It's been hit a lot by real asteroids, like actual asteroids. Any signs that it's been hit by black holes?
Indeed it has. And so this is a search that's ongoing. We have done our first attempt, and the sizes of these black holes mean that their craters are only a couple meters in size. So think about the size of a car. You could, you know, comfortably fill up one of these craters just by standing in it. And the highest resolution surface scans that we have of the moon are about a football field per pixel, so like order 65 meters. And as a result, the craters are too small to even show up as one pixel, if they exist. So we've done a search for them as a proof of concept computationally through all of these images, and we can't push low enough to find them. But that doesn't mean they're not there. What we hope is that some future generation of satellite will take surface images that are 10 times higher in resolution. And with that, we could reasonably test this hypothesis.
Well, how could you tell the difference between a crater made by a black hole and one made by an asteroid?
That is another fantastic question, Bob. So a regular crater is rock hitting rock. So that's like a point explosion. That's like piling up a bunch of TNT on the surface and then detonating it. That's going to make those nice big round basin craters with the ejecta blankets around it, that little sloping anthill that sort of comes away from the crater. A black hole doesn't do that, precisely because it goes straight through the moon. The black hole is accreting matter, creating this high density, high pressure, high temperature volume around it. And it does this as a big stripe. So instead of having a point explosion, like the TNT on the surface or the asteroid hitting it, you have a line explosion. You could think it's the difference between having all of your TNT in a big pile on the surface versus drilling a borehole and then filling that with TNT and then detonating it. The cratering dynamics and how it spreads matter around the crater are going to be different, resulting in a different crater shape.
So would you have a hole right through the moon and an exit crater on the other side?
You do get an exit crater on the other side. So this is fortunate for us. If a later asteroid comes and overwrites one of them, you still have the other one on the far side. So you don't have to worry too much about that. The hole through the moon, fortunately, the moon's not Swiss cheese. If you are deep enough in the moon, the pressure is high enough that the sort of sand and rock will flow back and fill it in. So you shouldn't think of it as like you're going to look through and see out the other side. This is going to, on the surface, look like a crater. It's just going to have different dimensions than asteroid or impact-made craters.
Okay, so we haven't seen any black hole craters on the moon yet, but possibly with instruments and better resolution, we might spot them.
You got it.
Dr. Kaplan, thank you so much for your time.
Yep, so good to be here. Thanks, Bob.
That was Dr. Matt Kaplan, a professor of physics from Illinois State University. Now, what's exciting is that if these tiny primordial black holes are the answer to the dark matter mystery, we might already have the observations we need to find them. Theoretical physicists from Belgium are proposing we could find indirect evidence of them from outside of our Milky Way galaxy. All we have to do is look for the shadow of the shattered remains of stars they've destroyed. Nicolas Esser is the lead author of the study and PhD candidate of theoretical physics at the French Free University of Brussels. We caught up with him in Montreal. Hello, Mr. Esser. Welcome to Quirks and Quarks.
Hello, Bob. Thanks for having me.
So where do you think we might be able to detect primordial black holes?
Well, one possibility to study ultra-thin dwarf galaxies. These galaxies are small galaxies which are satellites of our own galaxy, the Milky Way.
Small galaxies. Now, why these dwarf galaxies and not our own Milky Way?
So, in these galaxies, we have seen from observations of the motion of the stars that there must be more dark matter in there, and hence potentially more black holes. So, if they are the mass of an asteroid, they would actually be the size of an atom, and we wouldn't be able to see them, which is why we need some indirect way of probing them.
Okay. Since we can't see black holes, what are we going to see with the stars and their relationship to the black holes?
So One possibility is that if primordial black holes exist and are roughly of the mass of an asteroid, what could happen is that when stars form, it actually starts from a huge cloud of gas, a cloud which is like tens of times the size of our own solar system. And this cloud of gas, when contracting, will carry with it the primordial black holes that are moving around in this cloud. And these black holes would be carried with the gas towards the final product of this contraction, which is the star. And since this scenario works better for heavier stars, what could happen is that this black hole would end up, well, completely stuck in the star and would eat it.
Oh, I see. So they would get caught up in the big cloud, just slow down by friction because they're so small, and end up inside the star. So what happens from that point, a star with a black hole in its center?
What happened from that point is that, well, we know that black holes, they basically attract everything that's around them. And once you've entered a black hole, you cannot get out. And what would happen is that the matter in the star would slowly get attracted inside the black hole, would be basically slowly eaten. The technical term is accreted. And the black hole would slowly eat the particles of the star. And in a few million years, what could happen is that the stars would be completely destroyed and there would be nothing left apart from a remnant black hole, which would be roughly the mass of this initial star.
Holy smokes. Talk about indigestion, a star being eaten from the inside out.
Yeah, that's kind of the idea.
Now, you mentioned that this would only happen to big stars. Why is that?
Well, the reason is that if you have a bigger star, this means you have a stronger gravitational attraction. And also you start with a bigger cloud, which means that you just have a higher probability of capturing a black hole and of getting an indigestion when you have a bigger star.
Okay. So then, where will the data come from when you're looking at these dwarf galaxies that will tell you that these primordial black holes are there, that they've eaten these stars?
So the observation we could use is called the mass function of the stars. And this basically is just the information of how many stars you have for a given star mass, right? So this gives you the function of the number of stars that function of their masses. And we can observe, we can measure this using our last telescopes, such as the Hubble telescope, the James Webb telescope, as well as the Euclid telescope. These telescopes could allow us to measure these mass functions. And if we see that heavy stars are missing, then this could give us a hint that there is primordial black hole in the dwarf galaxy.
Oh, I see. So it's what you don't see in these galaxies that tells you the black holes are there, if the big stars are missing.
Exactly.
How far along in this process are you to count how many big stars are missing out of these galaxies?
So actually, there already exist measurements of star counting in these galaxies. These measurements exist. What we are trying to do now is to, well, obtain these results, which are now in the hands of other astrophysicists, and try to analyze the data with this idea that high mass stars should be missing.
Okay, so if you do detect that these big stars are missing from these dwarf galaxies, and that shows that there's probably black holes there, what would that say to you about the idea that primordial black holes are going to solve our dark matter mystery?
I wouldn't say it would be like a pure confirmation that there is asteroid mass primordial black hole in these galaxies, but it would be a great hint towards this idea. But of course, there could be some other astrophysical explanations for missing high mass stars in these galaxies, but it would be a hint and would motivate further study.
How much closer would your observations bring us to the idea that these primordial black holes even exist?
It cannot be a proof because it's still indirect, so there can be other explanations. But if you combine different observations, among which would be these observation of missing high mass stars, then at some point you would be, well, convinced that, okay, that it must be these black holes, because we have 3, 4, maybe 5 different observations. They all correlate. They all say, okay, there should be black holes. So it would be a step, among others, to prove the existence of these black holes.
Mr. Escher, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me again.
That was Nicolas Esser, a PhD candidate at the French Free University of Brussels. And that's it for Quirks and Quarks this week. If you'd like to get in touch with us, our email is quirks@cbc.ca, or just go to the contact link on our webpage at cbc.ca/quirks, where you can read my latest blog or listen to our audio archives. You can also follow our podcast or get us on the CBC Listen app. It's free from the App Store or Google Play. Quirks and Quarks is produced by Livia Dyring, Olsi Sorokina, Amanda Buckowitz, and Sonia Biting. Our senior producer is Jim Lebbins. I'm Bob McDonald. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.